is Greg Coleridge. We are here in a session at the Democracy Convention here in the Twin Cities. This session is on judicial review as a concept. I have been tasked with doing some big picture framing for the U.S. specifically. Greg will then talk a little bit about some international framing and global perspective, compare and contrast, and then we'll get into a genuine discussion. So I like to actually introduce myself as I'm David Cobb, and I am a straight-up revolutionary. I don't make any bones about that, because I believe that we need to restructure this society. I think our current country and the world is fundamentally racist, it's fundamentally sexist, it's fundamentally class oppressive, and these huge transnational corporations are going to destroy the planet that we depend upon for life itself if we do not stop them. And I'll go one step further. As a lawyer, almost all of the harm, abuse, exploitation, oppression, degradation, and destruction that is happening is legal under law. So, that's a big sort of introductory statement, but I do it to ground myself, because it's true, and to hopefully inspire others who may think like I do, but not feel like it's okay to say out loud, to say it out loud too. So if you actually think that we need to restructure this society, whether you like it or not, you're actually a revolutionary. You see, if you think the current systems in place are basically fair, basically just, basically good, and we just need to tinker at the margins, then that's okay. That's a position that you can take. It's not my position. I think we need structural, systemic, revolutionary, radical change. And part of that is because of the U.S. Constitution and the legal system. Because I want to just give a brief overview and get into the discussion, I'm really just going to hit three big picture concepts, and we can go deep during the discussion on all of those. The first is democracy. Anybody know what language that comes from?
Greek,
very good. Let's break it down. Demos means
people.
The people. Kratia, K-R-A-T-I-A in Attic Greek means? Anybody know? It means rule or govern. So literally the word democracy means the people rule. Pop quiz, how many of y'all believe we the people rule in the United States? Raise your hands, don't be shy. And for those of you listening on KFAI radio, not a single hand goes up in the crowd. Because you know what I know, which is we the people are not ruling in the United States today. In fact, there is a small ruling elite. You can call them the oligarchy, you can call them the plutocracy, you can call them the 1%. Lots of ways to describe the fact that there is a small group of people who are making the fundamental decisions about how this society is organized. We do not actually live in a functioning democratic republic in the United States of America, notwithstanding the creation myth of this country, notwithstanding what I was taught in public schools from elementary to junior high to high school. In fact, if you follow the education certification process, not the self-education that life itself will give you, but if you actually just go through the schooling system in the United States, unless you are blessed to have a radical truth-telling teacher somewhere along the way, the curriculum of education in the United States does not begin to actually tell the truth about the founding of this country, or about empire, or about the bigger pictures of white supremacy, capitalism, patriarchy, and imperialism until you reach college. I submit to you that's mostly because they recognize that if you just begin to tell the truth to children from the beginning, then they will begin to question all of the other lies that are built in and hardwired, literally baked in to the creation myth of this country. It's sort of like, not until you're adults are you able to actually handle the awful truth associated with it. The second word on the board is constitution, right? I want to be clear as a lawyer that this is, it's not just the U.S. Constitution, right? But in a legal concept, what is the idea of a constitution in the Western legal sense? Anybody know?
Basis of law.
Thank you so much. What's your first name?
Barra.
B-A-R-A.
Barra.
Barra. The basis of law. In fact, in the United States of America, the U.S. Constitution is, quote, the supreme law of the land. Right? The Constitution, if you break that down, constitute to create, it literally is, this is the entire legal framework for how our system is supposed to operate. It is the basis of law. It is the supreme law of the land. So if I am correct that the United States of America is fundamentally racist, sexist, and class oppressive, and I am, then we might say that the, or expect that the constitutional framework is fundamentally racist, sexist, and class oppressive. And it sort of is. And this is the point, because I don't want to oversell it or undersell it. This is something to unpack, right? Because just like the history of the United States has actually been a history of struggle, right? I mean, there has been, it's not like it is static. History is actually made by ordinary people who were engaged in the process of living, experimenting, and trying to make the United States live up to the concepts of liberty, justice, and equality, right? I mean, because, and this is a very important concept. So the other thing that I want to say about the Constitution as the supreme law of the land, in essence, it is a property rights document, not a human rights document. When I say that, does anybody know what that means or want to hazard a guess at it?
Property rights.
No? Right. So I'll just frame it up. So I submit to you that when you read the Constitution in its entirety, and when you read the arguments being made in the Federalist Papers and the other places that attempted to, or successfully, in fact, adopted the U.S. Constitution to replace the Articles of Confederation, what you'll find is that it is mostly about protecting the property rights of a small ruling elite from the inception. You know, the Constitution begins with three hallowed words.
We the people.
Yeah. We the people. Man, that even to this day, that can get goosebumps for me, right? We the people. Because done right, it compels us and it challenges us and it makes us think, we the people, we govern ourselves. We are rejecting the concept of monarchy. We are rejecting the concept of a ruling elite. We are collectively saying that we actually rule ourselves. So, pop quiz number two, in what year was the U.S. Constitution actually ratified?
1789.
Nicely done! Sue for the win, 1789. Right? 1791 is the adoption of the Bill of Rights, which is really interesting. But in 1789, that document begins, we the people. So, going further in 1789, who was a person who could claim the rights that are going to be described later in that document?
White.
So they had to be white. What else?
Male.
They had to be male.
Property owners.
Oh, this is an important one, Barra. Because it's not just all the white men. Just ask any of the indentured servants from England or Scotland or Ireland. Right? My people. You know, and for the purposes of the radio, I have white skin. You know, that's the pigment that I have. But my ancestors would not have been considered persons. Because my people did not own property or land. And in fact, are there anybody in this crowd who, like me, know you descend from Irish stock? Anybody? Yeah, always at least a couple of hands go up. Congratulations, sir. You and I are, historically speaking, recently white.
I'm half Italian. Does that count?
No, actually. Depending on what region you were from. But the point is, for the Irish, there's a great book that I would commend to your reading, How the Irish Became White. If you really want to understand the intersection of the construct of whiteness, the construct of money, the construct of law itself, and how it all interchanges, this idea of otherization is a very important one. So in 1789, when the Constitution is created, we the people only consisted of white male property owners. This is a very important idea. So the Constitution is the supreme law of the land. It is justifying and legalizing how the actual system already operates. I will submit And we can debate if you like, but I know I am on very firm ground when I tell you, at its core, the U.S. Constitution is a property rights document, not actually a human rights document. It is true that there was a series of rights under the Bill of Rights after the Constitution, which is now part of the Constitution, but in an international human rights framework and international law, those would all be considered political rights.
How much property did you have to own?
Depending on what the right in each state, it all had to do, was all either local or state state law. And in terms of voting, for example, all states had sort of different versions of how much actual land you could you had to own for what election was taking place. It's a great question. So the last concept on the board, again, this is just a framing session before we get into some compare and contrast internationally, and then I hope some discussion. The last concept on the board, judicial review. Anybody want to give me a short one, two sentence definition of the concept of judicial review?
The federal judiciary will decide whether the laws do or do not fit within the Constitution.
Well done, Don, for the win. Not only a producer, host of KFAI Radio, but also a legal historian. The concept of judicial review, I really can't say it any better. It is literally the legal doctrine concept that the federal courts or judiciary have the authority and even responsibility to decide if laws passed at the local level, state level, or even federal / congressional level, actually pass constitutional muster. If the legislature, local, state, federal legislature, has the authority to pass such a law under our constitutional framework. So for bonus points, in what part of the Constitution, what article is the concept of judicial review described?
Not in there.
Oh, good job! It's a trick question. Say it louder for the recording.
It's not in there.
It's not in there. Literally, the concept of judicial review that grants court authority to decide if democratic laws are allowed to be enforced is literally not in the Constitution. In fact, the Supreme Court of the United States claims the right. In an infamous case, I know, right, Sue?
Yeah.
I wish that we were on video, folks, so you could see the shock, the awe, but that can't be true. Look, we're getting from one of our folks. The case, in case you really want to challenge me or learn more, is Marbury versus Madison. And by Madison, I mean, yes, that Madison. From the era of the colonial founding of this country, and Marbury versus Madison, I could give you the story, but it's kind of boring. But at the end of the day, really, it was all about just an appointment to a federal position. And the Supreme Court actually said that the Madison did not actually have the authority to actually make that grant under the congressional legislation that authorized it, and therefore it was not a justiciable, or it was not a case that the court would have to actually uphold. So Don, how am I doing so far? Is this, yep, so Don gives me the thumbs up, so he knows that the bonus question is true. So, before I turn it over to my colleague, the concept of democracy is that the people rule, that we have the authority to rule ourselves, to govern ourselves. The concept of the Constitution is the legal basis. It is the supreme law of the land. It is the set of legal doctrines and framework by which disputes are supposed to be resolved and how we're supposed to actually govern our country. It is a property rights document at its core, not a human rights document. The third concept is judicial review, that the court has asserted and claimed the authority to actually decide when democratically enacted laws are actually authorized under the Constitution itself. It is probably one of the most profound power grabs that has ever happened, at least in the legal basis. there's some maybe similarities between the money system and just grabs of power and authority, but it is an assault on the concept of sovereignty. Let me finish this, and I'll come to you. At the end of the day, if you want to go deeper on this, there is a great book by law professor Larry Kramer called The People Themselves, which is the concept of how would actual how would the people themselves be able to collectively involve? Because I do want to point out, I do personally think that there is a place for the Supreme Court to be able to ensure and act as some sort of regulator against, you know, profoundly offensive, and not just politically offensive, but I do believe that human beings have rights, and my right to marry outside of my gender, if I or within my gender, my right to speak, my right to organize, all of the Bill of Rights, I do believe that those are sacred and sacrosanct. I don't think that they're dependent upon the democratic process. The court should be able and willing to come in and step in to overturn a democratically enacted law if it is a clear and obvious violation of constitutional rights. And that's what's so important to recognize. The courts now, though, are using this doctrine almost willy-nilly. We have ceded almost all of our power and authority by waiting to see what the courts will allow us to do or not do. It is fundamentally undemocratic. It is fundamentally submissive and obsequious. And frankly, for a self-governing people, we should only allow that to happen if there is a clear and unambiguous example of a local, state, or federal government that is actually violating an actual human right. Sue?
So what is in the Constitution in terms of the powers of the Supreme Court?
It's all in Article 3 under the judiciary, and it is actually quite small. It describes that the U.S. Supreme Court will be the supreme law of the Constitution described the supreme law of the land, and the court, Supreme Court, is the court of last jurisdiction. So it's not actually there. It, at best, is very lightly and opaquely implied, but certainly not there. And with that, I'm going to end my framing and turn it over to my colleague, Greg Coleridge. Okay. Let's hear it for David and the Democracy Game Show. We're all a part of. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain.
Well, I want to talk about, not quite a game show, but the gaming of our democracy, which has to do with a different piece of it that David and I agreed in this session we wanted to address. First of all, both of us are connected to an organization called POCLAD, the Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy, which has been around since the 90s and was and still is, but began as a gathering of frustrated activists. Each in our own way, we're working on sort of traditional peace, justice, labor rights, environmental concerns, a variety of other sort of progressive, populist activities, concerns, but increasingly felt that we were being stifled in our ability to work with others to bring change. And that's what we were running up against was the power, increasing power, of never intended constitutional rights, what turned out to be, in the eyes of the court, sort of inalienable constitutional rights of corporations. And that group began to dig deep and through gatherings called Rethinks, Rethinking Democracy, Rethinking the Corporation, began to try to unearth. Now this was long before Citizens United, the McCutcheon decision, Hobby Lobby, and that which we, incredibly today, in the minds of at least the progressive community, has become sort of second nature. This awareness of corporate constitutional rights is out there. Still a lot of detail to learn and connections, but nevertheless, this was sort of brand new, at least in the modern age. And this group, Frustrated Activists, served as sort of a think tank and began to try to educate one another, each other, as well as those we were working with. For those who are with us on the radio, we invite you to check out the website, poclad.org, where there you will find a whole host of documents and articles and other resources that we think have a certain timelessness that can help even today, help us understand the kind of fix that we are in, the sort of gaming of democracy that is serving the interests of the 1%, the super duper wealthy. But as Poclad continued in its evolution toward a revolution, headed toward an understanding that it's not simply sort of these individual decisions that occurred around corporations being given constitutional rights, but we needed to look more fundamentally and profoundly at the whole thing of the Constitution, the whole overarching document that serves as the basis, as the foundation for our laws and for how we elect, how we choose to organize ourselves publicly and privately. And so it had become not all that long after its beginning to look at, you know, gradually and then more voraciously at issues around the Constitution and the impediments for real, authentic democracy that that document has provided, not often, and not provided more often. And part of that internal educational as well as external educational quest began to examine, and there are a number of resources that we, again, invite you to look at, poclad.org. One of the main features here at the workshop today, a couple of documents that were published as newsletters in what's called By What Authority. That was the monthly and still is more email now, By What Authority. So if you go to the website, poclad.org, click on the button, By What Authority, and basically over the last 15, maybe upwards of nearly 20 years, will be a variety of articles in various subcategories of how we have tried to link various issues and problems, not only connecting corporate constitutional rights to those issues and problems, but around issues of fundamental democracy or lack thereof. The piece of this, and there are many pieces to try to dig down deep and to deal with, that I want to focus on, that I think really dovetails pretty well with what David focused on, is this whole thing of the Supreme Court and how the Supreme Court or the Supremes is itself an impediment, not just the decisions it's made, but the structure itself, at least in our Constitution, which is not the case in other countries. And so this was a quest that I sort of spent a little bit of time on a number of years ago, thinking that, well, really based on the notion, like so many things we take for granted, that's part of the given culture, it's, you know, it's not to be talked about or not to be conceived of because, well, it's inevitable. What we have is how it's always been, how it always should be. We shouldn't even, therefore, need to worry about thinking about it being changed, that if you don't sort of like some of the decisions going on, you try to sort of change the overall culture a bit, and when those very few times come up when a Supreme Court person dies or chooses to retire, then there's this massive organizing where you try to get somebody a little less bad on there. But again, what is going on in our system and the givens is very different. So, what we think of as the Supreme Court and its role that it plays is, as David certainly inferred, in its best sense, is to serve as a check and balance, to try to keep in sort of some kind of, hopefully, inclusively democratic equilibrium, though that's never been the case, but relatively speaking, the executive and the legislative branches from going completely off the deep edge and edge as we would conceive it to be, and not to protect or amplify or make worse those situations and conditions. So in the best sense, that is supposed to be the role of the Supreme Court, to protect, again, what do we learn in Government 101? The checks and balance, and why we have, and why it's so important to have this body that is sort of beyond the reach of the people directly, is to prevent that horrific tyranny of the majority. Right? So that the rabble out there doesn't end up just squelching the rights of the minority. And there is a certain degree of legitimacy for that to happen. And we have a history. It's not just theoretical, it's actual. Think about, in recent times, what the court has done around trying to give rights to people of color in the 50s and 60s. Now, a lot of that obviously was confirmed and pressured by the social movement out there. But it was protected and ingrained and protected to the extent it can be through the courts. Same recently with gay marriage. Very important decision. We could get into a discussion about whether that goes far enough or not, but the point is there was a quote-unquote minority that the court is protected from the majority, so to speak, of state legislatures and executives putting ballot measures, as they did for a period of time, right and left to prevent people from expressing rights, basic human inalienable. Something to be said for that. But is there not a truth in the reverse? That maybe there is a tyranny of the minority against the majority. And it's not just tyranny of, but tyranny for the minority. The tyranny of course, comes from, well, it's who has the Supreme Court largely protected, oftentimes, the interests of, particularly on economic matters and political matters. Well, it has been a tyranny of these Supremes that have oftentimes been appointed by presidents and by confirmed by the Senate that has been pretty rightward, pretty anti-democratic. And if you think about the system in this country, how do those guys, and just recently gals, but mostly guys, and for the most part all white guys, come to be? Through an incredibly undemocratic system that was built into the original Constitution. Meaning, how do Supreme Court justices come to be? They are nominated by a president that, last time we checked, still is. Not a president that comes to be president through gaining the most votes, but by who wins the Electoral College. Not all that democratic of a beginning. And then the secondary confirmation in the original Constitution, confirmed by a Senate that was originally, again, not directly elected by the people. But originally, until the 17th Amendment, they were appointed by state legislators. A nifty sort of way to insulate power in a class of very few people to serve very few interests. So that's a tyranny of the minority, but it's also a tyranny for a minority, to serve the interests of or for wealthy individuals, the super elite, and of corporate interests, to organize capital, organize property, to affirm and confirm that power. That's how it's designed, with this kind of those three words at the beginning to give that veneer of real authentic inclusiveness. So great three words to start with, and to a great extent it sort of went all downhill from there. So that's kind of how the system was designed. And if you look at this article, and for those who are listening in, a couple of pieces that we handed out that you want to particularly look at and read and give us a hard time, feel free to email. There's a way to sign up to get a newsletter and send a message. Please do so on the website, poclab.org. The one piece is, what's the name of the?
The Case Against Judicial Review.
Case Against Judicial Review, dated?
2007.
And the other piece is Supreme Authority, the Growing Power of the U.S. Supreme Court, and Democratic Alternatives. So, you know, this piece goes into, not going to get into it, read for yourself, the many instances where the Supremes, or the Nine, as Jeffrey Toobin called them in a fairly recent book, spoke about the different ways. And it's not just going way back, it's still up to present time, not just Supreme Court decisions, not just Citizens United and the McCutcheon decision and Hobby Lobby, but even in more recent times over the last decade. We've seen instances of the corporation weakening class action lawsuits against corporations, broadening the immunity protections of pharmaceutical corporations from suits over defective medications, heightening the barriers against workers who sue over workplace retaliation and harassment, and the list goes on and on. So the question is, what do we do about it? And can something be done about it in this environment where we culturally are conditioned to believe, Tina, that there is no alternative? And certainly, even if we conceive of an alternative, there's nothing, is there, in the past or in the present that we can look to for any kind of viable alternative. That's not true. There are many countries, not just in fantasy land somewhere in some super futuristic novel or whatever, but today, who have constitutions that, at least on this question, have systems and structures that have a judiciary system as it relates to an executive and legislative branch that is far different, the relationship. And how those judicial appointments, Supreme Court head judges, come to their positions and stay in their positions is very different. And if you look on this document, you will see some categorical differences related to, first of all, these democratic alternatives, not simply in legal textbooks or some distant past, but presently in other nations, dealing with first, there are a lot of countries that have mandatory retirement age. Everything from 62 to 75. That's how it is in, you know, the private sector in many instances. That's how it is in certain, in fact, judicial appointments at a lower level, but not at the Supreme Court. But, as you can see, and there is a list with, and I should have probably listed, but there's probably 30 or 40, at least, countries that have mandatory retirement ages. So that is one way, is it not, to try to create, this is on page 2, go back. Second column, mandatory retirement age. So there is the list of nations with mandatory retirement ages. And many of you know, they're throughout Europe, across South America, all over the world. Finland, Germany, Ghana, Ethiopia, Netherlands, Niger, Sri Lanka, Ukraine, just many countries around the world that have this notion of mandatory retirement age. Second is terms and term limits. We don't have that here, right? You can stay for 20, 30, 40 years until basically you yourself decide you want to retire or you keel over. And here, terms and term limits range from 2 to 12 years in many of these countries. Some permit only one term. Others allow for consecutive terms. Still others require justices to cycle off before they can become eligible again. And there you have, again, a very exhaustive list of nations that have terms and term limits. A third category has to do with a much more inclusive appointment process that is very different than how we, even though it's ever so slightly better in relative terms than the U.S. system, because, yeah, the president still nominates, and yes, Congress still confirms, but at least the Congress, post-17th Amendment, is directly elected. So you can put some pressure on your senator, who happens to be a person who's going to vote on this, to vote for or against. And we did see, did we not, quite a bit of that over the last couple of months around the nomination, as fraudulent as that was in the minds of many, of Gorsuch. Incredible pressure, incredible organizing to try to get senators to weigh in against him. And so that inclusive process has just dozens of examples where there are just, and there's many different types of differing, more inclusive election or selection processes. And just a couple of them, in Bolivia, they have a direct election by citizens of judges nominated by the legislature. So the legislature will nominate some people and then you put it up for a popular vote. That's probably, at least from where I looked. And a great website that compares and contrasts constitutions across the world is one called Constitute, constitute.org. And you can even sort of put in whatever, you know, keyword you want to put in, you know, education. Are there constitutions that give protections or lift up basic rights of providing education? And you can see it's not perfect, but it's not bad. Certainly a hell of a lot better than what used to be out there. So that's a pretty interesting situation. There's legislatures exclusively elect or appoint justices. So this system takes place in the Republic of Congo, Costa Rica, Cuba, Honduras, Hungary, Lithuania, Macedonia, San Marino, Switzerland, others. So there's a system where the legislature will select or elect the Supreme Court justices. So other examples. Fourth category is a weakening of judicial review. Here is an instance, okay, so one way we're going to try to have a greater checks and balances over the justices is to reduce their power, to make it more akin, either equal to or maybe even subordinate to the powers of the legislative branch or the executive branch. There are strong traditions and rules exist in several European countries, placing judiciaries in more equal, if not subordinate, roles. And here France, both in past and present, has a much more egalitarian system, one in which the judiciary is much more on par, and actually subordinate to, in which only a constitutional council there in France can review the constitutionality of a proposed law before it is enacted. So they can weigh in beforehand, but once it's enacted, they have very little power. And so there's other examples of in the United Kingdom and in Canada. And then there are other alternatives that are sort of just random out there. Additional ideas have been suggested, not necessarily in existence, but are hot. And that's certainly true in this country, but also has been brought up in other countries. Everything that could be included or excluded, things like, well, should citizens have the right to overturn Supreme Court decisions via national referendum? Okay, so we don't like the Citizens United decision, or take your pick. Maybe we should put this up for a national vote. Or maybe we should be able to create constitutional law. That's another way to weaken courts, by giving we the people the right to create referendums. And there are a number of countries. Switzerland may be one of the more inclusive democratic, and there have been a number of examples right now, and for my friends in the monetary reform circles, something right now that's in the offing with the number of signatures that have been gathered over the last, when was it submitted? Last year, year before, over, I think, money creation, something along those lines. That they come up with enough signatures to qualify, it goes through the legislative branch, and there's a certain waiting period, and then at some point it comes up for a vote. So there are a number of ideas, a number of suggestions, a number of alternatives out there that, again, are not simply theoretical, they're actual, and they need to be part of our thinking and part of our conception as we try to redesign, or maybe more appropriately for the very first time, design a constitution that is much more thoroughly democratic. Yeah.
So that's obviously sort of presentation style, right? We did solicit some questions along the way, but we really wanted to acknowledge and honor the fact that Don is here. But now let's just have a conversation about this, right? Because we both know that this is, it's heavy stuff, right? And for some people, peering behind and starting to peel the layer of the onion can be challenging. So if there are any just questions, if there are just broad comments, if anybody wants to push back and say that we're nuts. So number one, number two, number three, number four, number five. Are you just scratching?
No, no.
When I'm facilitating you scratch your ear, you either get called on, or you just bought a hog, depending on where you are. But my little trick for facilitating works very well if you remember your number. So please remember your number. Let's go to comment or question number one.
I have two questions. So this movement sort of started about 20 years ago. How would you respond to the criticism that you're just upset with the tenor of the decisions that the court was issuing at that time, that you didn't object during the Warren court era, for example, in the 60s, where it seemed like there was an expansion of rights of people? And a second comment is, our state, for example, does have a mandatory retirement age for Supreme Court justices. Yeah. I imagine there's a variety, just like there is around in countries, there's a variety in states. We have term limits. We have terms, but not term limits in the state of Minnesota. Right. And how do states compare in terms of outcomes, or how do countries compare in terms of outcomes that have these different forms of judiciary?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a very, very long answer, but there's two parts to that. One is at the state level. You're right, a lot of these things that we think, we can't conceive of at a federal level exists at a state level, right? Including being elected. Now, of course, money and elections can pollute and pervert all of that stuff, but nevertheless, a number of states don't have appointments at all, whether they're mandatory terms or age limits. They're directly elected just like your legislators. Now, it may be for a longer term, and there's some advantages to that. So those kinds of examples and alternatives already exist at the state level. Now, outcomes, there's a lot of factors related to that, certainly at the state level, based on whether they're rented, leased, bought, or retained, right, by whoever funds them. International level, you can see the countries. It's across the board. There are some countries that we would consider to be, quote unquote, more or less democratic. And that's due to, obviously, more considerations than simply how Supreme Court justices exist. So it's a longer discussion.
Well, I would just add to this notion of, well, why don't we object when there are expansion of actual human rights on the part of courts? Because it's the right thing, is one. I mean, we have to understand that if we're actually serious, we're talking about the struggle for human rights, we're talking about the struggle for democracy, the struggle for sustainability, the struggle to actually create a world that is worthy of living in. And it's also really important to understand, and I want to give a hat tip to the folks at the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, as well as and specifically Jan Edwards, Molly Morgan, and Mary Zepernick, and a host of others, who created a timeline of corporate constitutional rights. And when you look at that timeline, you recognize that the only time that the courts ever expand human rights is because of mass social movements that are broad and deep, making those demands. It's just never the case that the courts just decide because of some refined legal argument or some like moment of clarity around fairness or justice. It literally is always about social movements actually trying to push and expand the notion. So I'll take that head on. Your challenge is well made, and I accept it. You damn right I will defend the use of the legal system to protect human rights every damn time. Number two.
So there was a time when the right-wing John Birch Society had billboards against the Supreme Court. And let's just argue for a time. So if you delegitimize another institution of society, does this give the right wing carte blanche to do more land seizures, taking over properties throughout the West, kind of pushing this kind of different philosophy because there's the grounding that supposedly holds us together. But anyway, just deal with it as you will.
So the question is, do these conversations give the right wing more power, more authority, more carte blanche to do what they're doing? Short answer, no. I got news for you. They're already doing it, right? I mean, like, the right is so much further ahead than the left in terms of building mass movements, building bases, building the the framework, both intellectually, politically, theoretically, and legally, for the world that they want to look at. Look at the American Legislative Exchange Council. Where they weren't, they were definitely paying attention to legal doctrines, and not just individual laws, but legal doctrines. They have their whole notion of expanding property rights. They are spending hundreds of millions of dollars right now at the court system on legal scholars and so forth. So what I would say is it's about damn time that progressives or leftists got into this game in a serious way and stopped thinking that the court was somehow going to protect us. There's no doubt about it, Don, that, you know, like, I wasn't alive, right? But historically, during the Warren era, the John Birch Society had the, you know, impeach Earl Warren was an actual campaign. And why? Because of the decisions associated with protecting human rights. Because it was actually an effort to begin to go through another framework. But now they never dealt with capitalism. They never dealt with white supremacy. They never dealt with the bigger structures. But it was just a teeny bit more progressive or left or however you want to decide. So it sent them apoplectic. But I ask you this. Was it Supreme Court decisions that actually created the culture for the rise of Donald Trump as an individual? And not just Donald Trump, but the literal beginning of a neo-fascist regime and culture within this country. Because I'll go one step further and tell you this. The neoliberalism nurtured and created through the Democratic Leadership Council and the Democratic Party and the Democratic National Committee, which began in the late 1980s and really came aboard during the 1990s, that's what has actually created the right wing that we're actually experiencing now. So we the people have got to begin to organize across races, sectors, classes, and recognize that we're in a fight for who's going to actually govern this country.
I would just respond to that very briefly by saying that not necessarily trying to get rid of Supreme Court, we're trying to make it more democratically accountable in some appropriate way. And I think that adds to, ultimately, the legitimacy. Because right now, that branch of government is not all that legitimate. And it's cutting across the board. Obviously, with the Gorsuch person on the left, they don't believe it. But even on the right, recent polls have shown, at least on some of these questions, that we should have. So, one, 70% of people support abolishing lifetime appointments and allowing justices to serve only a fixed term. And that includes 72% of Republicans, 71% Democrats, 69% Independents. So I think as the court has become perceived of, if not actually, more quote-unquote political, people are saying, wait a second, there's something that needs to be done.
Number three.
I have a comment.
Only if it's super brief, because you're already on the stack. So if you have a super brief comment, you can make it.
Yes. I just want to say I have friends who are what you would consider conservatives, and they're not ALEC conservatives, but they're conservatives. They own farms, and they're very, very clear on their legal rights, and I respect them for that.
Number three.
I was struck by something that the courts in the United Kingdom issue a declaration of incompatibility. So that's saying whether something is constitutional or not constitutional. And the thing that pulls my hair out about a lot of the way our country is run is that it just deviates from the basic logical premises. You know, that if you posit that to get away from oligarchies and monarchies, the principle, we operate under the principle that we are all equal, so therefore any laws we make should not enhance some inequality, if you can identify a class or a race or something that's doing it. So you have every law should conform to that principle if it's going to be compatible reasonably. And then you get to, we create a government, and I know this is in the Declaration of Independence and not in the Constitution, but it seems like the Declaration of Independence is about the goals, and the Constitution becomes the action plan for those goals, that we're creating a government to secure life, okay? And so that's got to be for everybody, you know, the equal application of that.
Sure.
And then secondarily, liberty. Now, it's possible that my liberty could interfere with your life, and so these are ordered rights, okay? So the right to life is above somebody's right to liberty if they ever come into competition.
When they come into
competition. When they, yeah. Well, they certainly do, you're right there. And I also think that logically, you know, these were presented in the Declaration in this order. If you have no life and you have no liberty, then you cannot pursue happiness whatsoever. So pursuing happiness is subjugated to liberty too. You know, I mean, you have to, I mean, your happiness, your own personal effective response to your environment cannot interfere with somebody else's liberty or somebody else's life or unfairly place you above someone else. Is there something wrong with my logic that these things are the arguments about what is constitutional, you know, or what is consistent with the basis of, you know, how we administer the communal power? There also has to be some discussion about what the commons are and how the commons secure life and maintain liberty.
Yeah. Well, we're the principles. Everything behind the Constitution started with a set of principles, and I think you're bringing up values and principles that potentially conflict with one another.
So, do you want to talk about the his response to the first part about the?
Go ahead.
All right. So, I'll actually take the second one around the order of rights, and I think you're absolutely correct. And I think that Greg's answer just touches on the surface. I'll actually go just one layer deeper to say these are first principles conversations. When we talk about the concept of democracy, the Constitution, judicial review, the creation of money, these are some of the things that are going to have not just implications, but profound implications about everything that is even absolutely possible. And what we're trying to do with the program on corporations, law, and democracy is ask the questions. We're not presenting this as if we have the conclusive answers. What we have are a series of ever deeper questions about what it is that we want to do. Now, you know, at PokeLab, we used to do a series of a day-long and sometimes weekend-long workshops called Rethinking the Corporation, Rethinking Democracy. Now, in my capacity as a fellow with the Liberty Tree Foundation, which is the organization that literally brought this entire democracy convention together, I'm doing something called Movement Schools for Revolutionaries. Because actually, it's literally built on the beginning stages of the notion of the Rethinking Corporations, Rethinking Democracy, but is actually now going much, much deeper. Because I have, through the course of my own evolution, literally come to the part where I can say with comfort and honesty, I'm a revolutionary. I think we need to restructure the society. And I want to engage with people like you and listeners and others on the concept of how can we, in fact, restructure this society. Now, I want to be clear. I'm a nonviolent revolutionary. I do not believe in using violence as an affirmative political tool. I don't believe in using violence to try to seize state power. I believe in trying to engage a revolution over the ideas, over culture itself, and over the political and economic institutions. So you ask a very deep question that in the course of a short session like that, there's just not a glib answer.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, there's just not, because it's a first principle question.
Because it's so basic.
And if folks, both listening on KFAI or here, would like to get in touch with me about trying to see about bringing either me or one of my colleagues to your community to do a Movement School for Revolutionaries, you can reach me at David K. Cobb at gmail.com, and let's just talk about trying to do that. Number four.
Okay, both of us raised our hand.
Oh, you were number four?
I was number four.
Oh, you jumped the stack.
Oh.
Well, we were next, but we both raised a hand, so I was going to make her four and a half.
All right.
So, she's my friend. I have to include her. You go first.
Oh, all right. I wanted to offer a little pushback, and I've got a reason for this. The Constitution, the way I see it, is really a commercial document. It was the property rights that were and the voting rights that were defined by the states, the way I understand it. So in Vermont, you had, in the beginning, they gave women the right to vote. I think free blacks the right to vote. The reason I'm saying that and why I think it's an important point is because money, as defined in the Constitution, is tied up with commercial rights. And so when they were defining commercial rights, it was part of the way that money would be regulated and controlled, the value thereof. And they eliminated the Indian nations, and the trade between the states was not part of that. Mm-hmm. So the oligarchy.
So your assertion is it's not property but commercial?
It's commercial rights, particularly international commercial, because the states themselves would govern, and between the Indian nations, they would govern, decide the rules for the basis of trade between them. The uniting part of that was the monetary system, which gave Congress and that was one of the problems with the Articles of Confederation. It didn't give a strong enough element to monetary creation and regulating the value thereof and telling the states, look, you cannot create money, which they were doing, and it was messing things up. So the commercial, what happened after that, you got the small A aristocrats always there, always forming, you know, Hamilton left in a huff because nobody wanted his monarchy. And the Bill of Rights were formed because it's really a Bill of Forbiddens, so we get confused with that. And the right out of the gate, Hamilton starts with the Federalists of, you know, inserting the money power, if you will, with his financial plan, which included creating money as banknotes, which was also a big fight. Marbury versus Madison is really important, and one of the elements I didn't hear, and maybe it was there, was that the Jefferson and company argued that each branch of government could decide the constitutionality, you know, of the law, and they should be able to do that. Now, would the Supreme Court have the superior place? Would that be a debate? I don't know, but this is just something I brought out.
No, I think it's a very valid point. You can take a stab at it, but my reaction is I would certainly be willing to add, not necessarily substitute, but add commercial, because I think property still in.
It's not
but,
really.
Who were slaves? Slaves were property.
Yes, but even in that clause, it's not defining, you know, they're just saying they added that in. And that was a problem. It was a compromise in the beginning.
Right,
it was a financial, monetary compromise, right?
Uh-huh.
But it's colorblind. It's gender. Harlan, the dissenting opinion, didn't he wrote that statement in Plessy versus Ferguson. I'm thinking that the Constitution was colorblind. And
so he said, but like, I'm sorry, I can't even wrap my head around somebody at a convention like this saying the Constitution is colorblind whenever, like, literally human beings are enslaved because of their pigment. Like, that just flies in the face. Like, so no, I'm going to, like, you can push back, and I'm going to push back 10 times on that statement.
Well, I think there's something to be said about commercial.
Oh, to be sure.
Yeah,
listening to it, I got to tell you, with all honesty, I think that we're getting into a level of distinction on semantics that is almost without a difference, the difference between property rights or commercial rights. All right, so if it satisfies you for the conversation, property rights and commercial rights, but I don't actually understand the distinction that you're...
Okay, I'll maybe
talk
later.
About it after.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So this is, in my head, the problem we're all having with the power, more and more power over the last century of corporations. Historically, I think, well, all of our 13 colonies, the corporation ship came over and started us. Like, the corporation is the legal idea, and the power behind that is a really very deep in history. And I think of, I learned from my friend Jerry, in 1600, was it Queen Elizabeth started the...
She chartered
a corporation called...
British East India.
It
had a different name then.
Which ended up with hundreds of thousands of military men going around the... So the idea of a corporation is deep in the legal history of
slavery, as is white supremacy, as is money, as is
Women not having being considered in a sense chattel.
But correct. That idea of a corporation—that's what
focused on. It's really interesting. And was it your friend who was asking the question on commercial? That insight is, I think, something I not only agree with, but was literally the genesis of the Rethinking Corporations, Rethinking Democracy, which we couldn't do in this small session as well, but we spent an entire day uncovering the history, and we've got a whole notion of what is a corporation under law, and what that, does that mean, and where do they come from? There was the British East India Company, and literally it became a... quasi-government in and of itself, with the largest empire, and by the way, a military even larger than was actually under the direct rule of the monarchs themselves. Oh, and by the way, another of the early corporations was called the Africa Trading Company. Anybody want to guess what the Africa Trading Company traded?
Slaves.
Human beings. Thank you, Bar. Because, like, honestly, in my head, the first word that would probably come up would be slaves, because I'm part of this culture. And this culture has taught me about slaves. And that's the language that we've been using. But I no longer will actually say that, because that actually is a way to frame something that is profoundly disrespectful. They weren't slaves, they were human beings who were enslaved, to be sure, but they weren't actually inherently slaves.
Yeah. Just one more thing about the commercial. I think that I just want to affirm that piece of it, which, you know, you're right, you just mentioned passing Articles of Confederation. That was our first quote-unquote constitution that was usurped by this second constitution that was written. Guys came together merely to amend, that was the intent, to amend the Articles of Confederation because of trade issues, because of commerce issues.
Yeah.
But once they got in, they locked the door and scrapped the whole thing and rewrote it.
So right, but I don't think, I don't see it as anti-democratic as what I'm feeling.
Then we can have the debate.
Yeah.
I mean, because this is not a casual opinion that I have. This is a deep conviction, and we can debate it.
Should we go to five?
Number five.
My question is when I'm trying to think about the move to amend, and I'm trying to think about, you know, what we're trying to overcome with the Citizens United, with all the grantings of the rights that, you know, how they get hit through corporations dealing with the law and stuff, and then at the very end of the piece, we mentioned national referendum, okay, and that there are some countries where national referenda, you know, that is the rule of the land. I mean, and so my question really is, how come we are not pushing for a national referendum? And as opposed to amend the Constitution, okay, which I'm just thinking of it out loud, you know, has to be passed by this, you know, the state process, go to the states individually, do it. And whereas the national referendum could be something that's just brought about in the Congress, you know, something that we could put forward through that. Yeah. And I'm just wondering, like, why is it today a lower priority, you know, than to amend the Constitution? I'm just wondering about that.
Well, one would have to, in the U.S., amend the Constitution to embed a national referendum provision.
Uh-huh.
So we would have to go through the same process. However, you do make a fair point of, if we had such a national referendum, that would become a potential tool that many groups could use then to bring about, as does exist in so many states through state referendums.
But could you just explain why we would have to amend the Constitution in order to go to national referendum instead of legal?
Because the Constitution is the supreme law of the land, and there's no mechanism to do to have Congress be able to grant themselves the authority. You can't do that through legislation.
Yeah, you simply can't. Or
that's a short answer. I mean,
or electing anybody. Yeah, you can't. I wish I could. Or do I wish we could? One sentence.
Number six.
You weren't talking about a constitutional convention.
No.
These other countries have a referendum.
Corporations are a creation of human beings, and they were created to serve a purpose, and that purpose served whoever created them. So they could have been a corporation that became an army, that became an empire or a branch of the empire, or became a way of building a bridge, and once the bridge was built, it died. I mean, corporations have done all of those things. It took American ingenuity to make corporations human beings. We are really powerful. I don't think any other country did that, did they? I mean, maybe, you know, I think we were the ones that invented that idea. And I would love to have you tell people how to get to the timeline, because that is a brilliant demonstration and documentation of how, for every step forward for us, the people, there were 8 or 9 or more steps forward for them, the corporations. It's a wonderful...
Yeah, there's a lot of places where you can access the timeline. It's being updated again.
If you just Google,
probably corporate history timeline, that'd be one. At the Move to Amend website, if you go to Move to Amend, in the search engine, put corporate timeline, it'll come up there, number of places. Or go to WILF, the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. They were the backbone, so to speak, of putting that together.
So, I thought you made a very important concept around like some really important things are really just social constructs. They're just like created by, they're not natural, they're not innate, they're not created by the goddess or physics or anything else. Human beings actually do them. One is the corporation. What's another really important thing that is just a construct, just created by humans, that end up having all sorts of profound structural cultural implications?
Money.
Thank you, money. Literally, a social construct created by us. We can decide how to create it, whether it's credit or asset-based, etc. We actually would have the authority to do that. What's another thing that's a social construct that just has huge implications in society itself?
Religion.
Here's the one I'm thinking about. Race. Race is a construct. Ask any biologist, and she or he will tell you race does not exist. I mean, surely pigment exists, and hair color, and facial features, and all sorts of things, but the concept of race was literally created by human beings, and you know why? To divide us. Right. The small ruling elite literally created the concept of the white race and the black race. Why? And we don't have time to go into it, but for the radio, for bonus points, read up on Bacon's Rebellion in this country. Literally the time that indentured servants who had pigment like mine, and I have white skin, and enslaved Africans with black pigment who were more or less both exploited, both oppressed. There were some distinctions, but not that much really in the day-to-day life. But what happened is they got together and led a rebellion against the ruling class and the ruling elite. The ruling elite said, oh my God, there's more of us than there are of them. We actually have to begin to separate and divide them. So they literally created legal privileges under law based on pigment and ethnicity. Do you think that they brought those white indentured servants all the way up to the same level as them? Of course not.
Didn't have to.
Didn't have to. Just had to give them enough privileges and then push the enslaved Africans down even more and begin the process and the depraved process of literally dehumanizing in every way, shape, and form. Push Africans down, lower, raise up just a bit, people with white skin, and then the fight then becomes amongst themselves over that ladder while the ruling elite laughs at us.
Well,
so
maybe,
these concepts, that the first principle social constructs around the role of the corporation, which is just an instrument and a tool, how do human beings actually come together to do things, the social construct of money, the social construct of race, to me, these are the ones that I would probably stop with to say, if we really want to understand the meta context of reality, race, gender, class, sexual orientation, if we don't want to understand white supremacy, imperialism, patriarchy, capitalism as an economic institution, these constructs, which we accept as inevitable, they are not. They can be recreated. They could be reconstructed.
Well, we are probably right at time, just to kind of close up from my end anyway. Many of the questions around corporation, the corporate construct, if you will, there are articles on the Polkland website. Again, a good place, sub-source for that is under the Bywood Authority. Do check that out. Again, for people who may be listening that want to find out more about and receive a monthly email, if not slightly more often, about what Polkland is up to. And this Bywood Authority will be summarizing, David and I, our experiences here at the Democracy Convention. Go to polklab.org. For those who particularly want to lift up and work on ending, again, much of the undemocratic nature of the Constitution, particularly around money and speech and corporations are persons, is what Move to Amend is working on, as well as the whole issue of trying to democratize the Constitution. That's movetoamend.org. For David's part, I'll take that over.
DavidKCobb@gmail.com is how to get in touch with me directly. I do my work these days mostly through the Liberty Tree Foundation for the Democratic Revolution and as a proud member and organizer for the Green Party.
So thanks for being here, and thanks for listening.
Thank you.
That's great. Very good.
Time might be a social construct, but I think that was Newton and Einstein's debate whether time is real or a social construct.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
It is.